Good morning. This is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, November 21st. For me, 2009 has been all about the stock market. We've run substantially higher thus far, as I forecast, and I didn't waver even at the heights of despair last March. But in looking ahead, I am still trying to get my arms around the economy, and thus I'm waiting until the last possible minute, like December 31st, before issuing any outlook for 2010. All I can tell you today is that the negatives outweigh the positives as I scratch it out on my legal pad. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke gave an important speech in New York this week, reiterating that the economy, while off the carpet, still has some major hurdles to clear before we see sustainable growth of a variety that puts a real dent in the unemployment rate. Bank lending remains sharply constrained, and banks continue to tighten terms, he said. The consumer and small business in particular are most heavily impacted, with the former worried over both his job and the ongoing negative wealth effect from what had been his prime investment, his home. Bernanke hardly offered much hope for the future when it came to labor, pointing to the excess supply of it, even greater than indicated, and as I've been pointing out the past few months, corporations are in many cases cutting wages, so again, household spending will remain restrained. While the chairman didn't say it, let me. Those who continue to say the Christmas shopping season will surprise to the upside are nuts. Globally, what does the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development say about the 30 developed nations it monitors? Glad you asked. In a nutshell, the OECD said growth has resumed, but it would likely fluctuate around a modest underlying rate for some time to come. How modest? Try 1.9% for 2010 and 2.5% in 2011. Unemployment will rise to 9% next year in the 30-nation group and only drop to 8.8% in 2011. That's what I call a putrid forecast. More specifically, both Japan and the 16-nation Eurozone are expected to grow 1.8% in 2010 and 2% in 2011, while the United States is forecast to post positive growth of 2.5% and 2.8% in 2011. Which I'd take about now. Downside risk in the stock market would be limited in that scenario. Then there's China, which by most accounts has been carrying the world, either from a market standpoint or its purchases of others' paper, like that of the United States, where China at last report owns $797 billion of U.S. government debt. So against this backdrop, President Barack Obama became the first U.S. leader to visit China in the first year of his term. I got a kick out of the likes of Bill O'Reilly, who stupidly questioned why he was there. He better have gone, even if nothing of substance officially came of the entire Asian trip, as I told you would be the case. It's about appearances and symbolism and, frankly, groveling. It's with good reason that the U.S. and China are now called the G2, far and away the most important bilateral relationship with finance and peace inextricably linked, as both Obama and China's leaders said during the visit. Obama got in his jabs on human rights, Tibet, and a free press, including free access to the Internet, but for the most part, Obama avoided even the mildest of controversies. That's what happens when you are no longer dominating the world as the United States has been used to since all of us have been on this planet. These days, Washington has a little bargaining power. Here are a few figures. In 2008, China exported $337.8 billion to the United States. U.S. exports to China were only $69.7 billion. In 2002, U.S. two-way trade with Japan, South Korea, Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Singapore exceeded Chinese trade with those countries. In 2008, each of them traded more with China than with the U.S. Which brings us to the currency issue. China's killing not just the U.S. by pegging the yuan to the falling dollar, but its Asian neighbors and Europe as well. China's been scared to death that if it lets its currency appreciate, its export economy will collapse, throwing tens of millions more in the streets with the risk of rising unrest. But a stronger currency would boost the purchasing power of Chinese households and encourage domestic consumption and less reliance on exports. The Chinese government knows this is the direction they eventually have to take, but they want to do it at their own pace, and with the global economy as fragile as it is, they're not about to take any drastic steps today to appease the rest of the world. The weak U.S. dollar and yuan are slamming Europe to the tune of 12.5% in revenues for the third quarter among Eurozone companies. That's huge. But Washington likes the weaker dollar at this moment because it keeps our own export industry from retrenching any further, and the only thing that is going to change the attitude of investors when it comes to the greenback, aside from a geopolitical event, would be a show of fiscal responsibility and declining deficits in the U.S. But when you have items such as a potential health care reform debacle, cap and trade, Congress' inability to reduce spending of any kind, TARP, and expiring tax cuts year-end 2010 that threaten long-term business plans, let alone reduce consumer spending, it's hard to see the rest of the world reaching the conclusion, you know, those Yanks have finally gotten their act together. They've recaptured their mojo. I don't think so. Not when you have the likes of economist Paul Krugman, who believe, perhaps not inaccurately, that the economy requires further government help. Krugman says, unemployment is in double digits. We desperately need more government spending on job creation. Banks are still weak and credit is still tight. We desperately need more government aid to the financial sector. But try to talk to an ordinary voter about this, and the response you're likely to get is, no way, all they'll do is hand out more money to Wall Street. Krugman's big complaint this week, as expressed from his perch at the New York Times, is that when government officials put together TARP and then rescued the likes of AIG, in their case to the tune of $180 billion, the government asked nothing in return from the bankers. Even though these bankers, read Goldman Sachs, received huge benefits from the rescue. Krugman notes, for the AIG rescue was part of a pattern. Throughout the financial crisis, key officials, most notably Timothy Geithner, who was president of New York Fed in 2008, is now Treasury Secretary, have shied away from doing anything that might rattle Wall Street. And the bitter paradox is that this play-it-safe approach has ended up undermining prospects for economic recovery. For the job of fixing the broken economy is far from done. Yet finishing the job has become nearly impossible now that the public has lost faith in the government's efforts, viewing them as little more than handouts to the people who got us into this mess. Krugman is largely spot on. He concludes, so here's the real tragedy of the botched bailout. Government officials, perhaps influenced by spending too much time with bankers, forgot that if you want to govern effectively, you have to retain the trust of the people. And by treating the financial industry with kids' gloves, they have squandered that trust. So what other issues do we have? This week, the data on October housing starts was a bummer, as the figure came in far lower than expected, and despite historically low mortgage rates for qualified buyers, mortgage applications continued to fall. Foreclosures also continued to rise, with a record 14.4% of all mortgages either delinquent or in foreclosure, and this figure is likely to rise higher still in 2010, because there is zero sign jobs are going to come roaring back. Economist Mark Zandi, who has been right throughout when it came to forecasting the real estate bubble, said, I think we're going to see another leg down. The only mild positive this week was that a key region, the six-county Southern California area, saw a further rise in the median home price for October. And I would say that nationwide, my projection from last year that the bottom in terms of median home prices this past April-May will hold, though I concede it's going to be close. Then there's this healthcare behemoth working its way through Congress with a Senate vote probable on Saturday that will allow debate on their version, though it's hoped the Republicans can block any vote on the legislation until cooler heads prevail, like until the new year. Robert Samuelson, Washington Post. Congress' far-reaching overhaul of the healthcare system would almost certainly make things worse. It would create new, open-ended medical entitlements that threaten higher deficits and would do little to suppress surging health costs. The disconnect between what President Obama says and what he's doing is so glaring that most people could not abide it. The president, his advisors, and allies have no trouble, but reconciling blatantly contradictory objectives requires them to engage in willful self-deception, public dishonesty, or both. The campaign to pass Obama's health care plan has assumed a false, though understandable, cloak of moral superiority. It's understandable because almost everyone thinks that people in need of essential medical care should get it. Ideally, everyone would have health insurance. The pursuit of these worthy goals can easily be projected as a high-minded exercise for the public good. It's false for two reasons. First, the country has other goals, including preventing financial crises and minimizing the crushing effects of high deficits or taxes on the economy and younger Americans, that health care reform would jeopardize. And second, the benefits of reform are exaggerated. Sure, many Americans would feel less fearful about losing insurance, but there are cheaper ways to limit insecurity. Meanwhile, improvements in health for today's uninsured would be modest. They already receive substantial medical care. Insurance would help some individuals enormously, but studies find that on average gains are moderate. Despite using more health services, people don't automatically become healthier. That was Robert Samuelson. To digress, am I mistaken or have we not seen any public service announcements, say from the likes of a LeBron James, on just general physical fitness? People laughed at Nancy Reagan and her Just Say No to Drugs campaign, but it worked. It's also frustrating, like the report that government paid out $47 billion in questionable Medicare claims the past year, or a report from the Office of Management and Budget that the government made $98 billion in improper payments in fiscal 2009, though Director Peter Orszag was unable to provide a breakdown on how much of this was due to fraud. $98 billion. No one knows why it was dispersed, but it shouldn't have been. It's a disgrace. Lastly, Iran, the P5 plus one, the five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, are to decide over the next few weeks whether to threaten Iran with further sanctions for its continued intransigence. Though, at a meeting on Friday, they wimped out, which undoubtedly Israel took note of. The deceitful Iranians never have formally rejected the offer to enrich their uranium if they would just ship it out, as they choose instead to work the clock in their now all too familiar stall game. There are three existing Security Council resolutions, plus five other resolutions, all ordering Iran to halt enriching its uranium, and they've just thumbed their nose, given us the finger, and threatened Israel with annihilation. This week, Iranian Foreign Minister Mottaki dismissed the possibility of further sanctions. Sanction was the literature of the 60s and 70s, he said. I think they are wise enough not to repeat failed experiences. President Obama said he wasn't about to just continue talks forever without any actual resolution to the issue. And it's true, he said he had to give it until the end of the year, but that must be Obama's line in the sand, regardless of what the others in the P5 plus one do, because while it would appear Israel is not going to launch a preemptive strike this month, as I sincerely felt would be the case, it is beyond belief to imagine an Israel that just sits back and lets Tehran get the bomb. Unfathomable. Some in Israel have actually said the state needs to prepare for this day. Never. I have never been more sure of anything in my life. Nor should you doubt for a second that Israel will let the mullahs control their fate. It's bad enough that a coup in Pakistan could one day be a source of nukes for terrorists, but Israel cannot control what transpires there. It can, however, have a say in Iran's nuclear ambitions, and yes, Israel will have to then brace itself for blowback when it does decide to set back Iran's program for a couple of years. The target will be Natanz. I've read all manner of reports on how difficult it'll be to carry through the mission, with or without U.S. help, including issues I've discussed in this space before, such as what routes do the fighter jets and bombers take, seeing as there is no good one. But the United States has supplied Israel with the latest in our bunker-busting arsenal, and while Natanz is not the lone critical facility, it is far and away where the most uranium is being enriched. EJ, a reader, passed along a terrific piece from Haaretz, a distillation of a study put together by strategists Tony Cordesman and Abdullah Toukan, and the author makes the following statement. The regime in Tehran is certainly a bitter and inflexible rival, but from there it's a long way to presenting it as a truly existential threat to Israel. Iran's involvement in terror in our region is troubling, but a distinction must be made between a willingness to bankroll terrorists and an intention to launch nuclear missiles against Israel. Boy, this is not Benjamin Netanyahu's position. And if it ever becomes the norm in Israel, they can kiss their future goodbye. PBS Frontline had another outstanding segment this week, this time on the death of Nida, the female protester whose murder came to symbolize last summer's protest in Tehran. Many of the Iranians are simply sick, totally nuts. There's no other way to describe them. And at the same time, your heart goes out to those who just want to lead a normal life with a modicum of freedom, but they don't have the power. So we're back to square one, trying to levy a new round of sanctions before Israel has to take actions into its own hands. If you're looking for something mildly positive in terms of Russia's position, last week it was the Iranians complaining the S-300 anti-missile defense system hadn't been delivered as promised by Moscow. This week, it was Russia's announcement that they wouldn't finish the Bashir nuclear plant as scheduled. This is not merely a coincidence. Let's hope that while China will balk over a new round of sanctions, Russia may agree to them. And of course, I keep harping on all this because it has everything to do with our financial markets. I'd watch my dollar positions, for one. Any strike on Iran and the greenback soars. Most of you know what that would then mean for the commodity trade that has worked so well this year. And I have to repeat, for those betting that oil will spike to $130 plus and stay there, I've been saying the Saudis would come to the rescue and flood the market with their ample spare capacity. Stocks finished mixed, with the Dow Jones adding 0.5% to close at 10,318, while the S&P lost 0.2% and NASDAQ 1%. The outlook from the likes of Home Depot, Lowe's, and Target was so-so. Have a great Thanksgiving, and I'll be back with you next Saturday, November 28th.